Catherine Bolkovac was a hard-working cop in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1999 who'd run into hard times. She'd lost custody of her daughters in a divorce settlement. She was looking for a new job that would give her the means to live near them. She'd heard she could earn good money in a short period of time by becoming part of the UN International Police Force in Bosnia, which is run by DynCorp, a private security agency. She signed on. Once there, she became alarmed when she saw human trafficking, mobsters transporting teenage girls for sex in bars and brothels, and outrage when she found that the security firm and UN personnel seemed to be all caught up in that trafficking. She tried to sound the alarm, and she was fired. The Whistleblower is the name of a new film starring Rachel Weisz as Catherine Bolkovac.
Should have seen this place. There were pictures all over the walls of guys with those girls. And almost every single guy in there is ours.
Catherine Bolkovac joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And take us back to that moment when, what did you first see that set off the alarm with you?
Yeah, the initial alarm actually started well before I ever got to Bosnia during the training session in Fort Worth, Texas. And one night just before leaving for Bosnia, one of the men who had done previous missions in Bosnia came bounding into the pool with a beer, stating where he could find really nice 12 to 15-year-olds once we got to Bosnia. I was the only woman in the group, but there was about five or six of us in the pool at that time, and dead silence, and we just really tried to put this, I think, statement in the back of our minds, think we must have misunderstood. But once I got to Bosnia and began my investigations, began my training, it was just so clear, and it wasn't even well hidden. These brothels were disguised as bars and hotels and strip clubs and dance clubs, and they were just scattered throughout the hills of Bosnia. And the clientele were all internationals. I mean, let's face it, the locals didn't have the money to spend on this kind of an operation. So the international money was definitely funding the flow of the trade.
And recognizing this is the story of the movie, but what happened when you said, boy, this is serious and tragic, we ought to do something about it?
Well, you know, I really tried to give my fellow officers the benefit of the doubt. But when a victim came forward who reported international involvement, someone who was highly identifiable or had a name badge, a description, a tattoo, I forwarded these cases on to the Internal Affairs Unit, but ultimately they were just trashed.
We told, as your character is told in the film, come on, this is war.
Yeah.
I found padlock rooms, young women's passports, and there was a lot of U.S. currency.
Where are we going, Columbo?
I don't know, but something up's going on.
Ooh. Honey, it's like I say, this is Bosnia. These people specialize in
And I think that's such a great escape. These women are whores of war. They're just prostitutes. They want it. You know, if they went out of this, why don't they whisper in our ears when we go into these bars that they're being held captive? And, yeah, there's just every excuse in the book. But, I mean, the same reaction is always there from the UN to the State Department to the corporations who are involved in this, and that is simply damage control.
There would be an occasional raid of a bar,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And what would result?
Well, the girls would be herded out of the bars if indeed they claimed to be trafficked. I mean, and so many of these girls were obviously not free to speak and were afraid for their lives and certainly weren't going to tell the very people who were perpetrating crimes against them who came to save them that they wanted out. The few girls that did escape or who would raise their hand basically and say, yeah, I want to go home, were herded out like cattle, put through a bunch of regulations and rules through various organizations. There were no safe homes to put them in. There was no psychological counseling. So they were ultimately sent home to their home countries if we could prove they had a home country. And ultimately probably picked up again many times. There's documented cases when they were met at the airport in their home country by corrupt police on the other end or traffickers and simply, you know, put right back in the trade. So it was just a vicious circle.
There's in a movie that's filled with jarring scenes, there's an especially emotional one where you're able to organize a raid and a young woman with whom you especially identify, Raya.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's play that scene.
I know this girl. I can't leave her here. Let's go. Come on, Raya, let's go. I can't leave her here.
Look at me, Kathy. We cannot force them. Nothing will hold up in court. Please understand. They will be brought down here, punished. You want blood on your hands.
Tough scene.
Did anything like that happen?
Yeah, not exactly that scene, but I did go on a bar raid. when I was in Zenica, a young woman had escaped and reported to me that other girls were captive there in the brothel in the hills. And ultimately, you went to this bar and found seven young women locked in a room upstairs, very similar conditions to what's portrayed in the film, with condoms hanging over the trash can, their clothes stuffed in plastic bags, and scared to death, stating they didn't want to be found floating in the river. You know, it was just so heartbreaking to see the tough exterior, knowing that these were just such young, innocent victims underneath.
What would make them not want to go with you?
Well, clearly it's the psychological trauma. These girls are sometimes willingly brought from countries thinking they're obviously going to go into these great jobs in the West and are forced into prostitution. But in order to do that, you don't just take the girl off the street and put her in a brothel and tell her to start working. You basically rape, abuse, and mortify these girls through horrible traumatic acts in order to get them to do that.
Did you feel, as your character does in the film, a tug between your own daughters and the young women?
I get asked that question a lot, and it's a yes and no, because any good cop will tell you that you're trained and taught to put those emotions aside when you're dealing with victims. But also any good cop will tell you that's almost impossible to do. Whenever you work an event that involves children, whether it's a child death or a sexual assault or incest or anything else, which is what my specialties were before I went into Bosnia, you learn how to compartmentalize a bit. But, I'd be lying if I said there certainly weren't moments when the children, my own girls, were going through my mind.
What do you want people to know about human trafficking?
This is not just about human trafficking. I think human trafficking needs to be looked at from all facets, and how organized of a crime this is and how corrupt the entire organizations are that are running this, and what's fueling human trafficking, which are many of these international missions and the demand side. So until we crack down on the demand side, all the theoretical and PhDs that are out there writing all these ethics policies aren't doing a bit of good.
Catherine Bulkovac, and she's portrayed by Rachel Weisz in the film The Whistleblower, which opens in select cities beginning on August 5th. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. But 15 years ago, the summer of 1996, the city of Atlanta hosted the Olympic Games. NPR's Kathy Lohr was assigned to cover them. She has this look back.
For me, two events still stand out from that summer. First, the opening ceremonies, which I covered from Centennial Olympic Park, where the festivities were broadcast for free on huge TV screens. It was a big party, and I stayed in the park for hours recording the event. Everyone was glued to the celebration, awed by each moment. Millions of people watched on TV, and thousands were at the park that sultry evening as Gladys Knight performed the classic Georgia on My Mind. The celebration continued with the parade of athletes entering the arena, and finally the Olympic torch, which had made its way through the neighborhoods, was carried into the stadium and finally passed to legendary boxer Muhammad Ali.
But look who gets it next. The greatest.
Ali's hands were shaking as he struggled to light the Olympic cauldron. And after a nervous moment or two for everybody here, a ball of flame eked up a long cable and finally did ignite the cauldron.
What a moment!
The other event, a tragic one, took place about a week later, when a pipe bomb hidden inside a backpack exploded in Centennial Park during a free concert. The bomb was placed not far from where I stood a few days earlier. Two people died as a result of the explosion, and hundreds were injured. Atlanta's Olympic organizers were horrified. This was Billy Payne appearing on NBC.
The Olympic movement remains one of the bright hopes of the future. We cannot deviate from our mission notwithstanding the great sorrow that we feel.
The games did go on, and spectators packed Olympic events the next day in defiance. Tourists also came back to Centennial Park when it reopened, a statement that no terrorist would win. But it took more than 5 years for federal agents to catch Eric Rudolph, who had fled to the North Carolina mountains to hide out. Rudolph was identified as the man responsible for several bombings in the South, including the one intended to disrupt the 1996 Games. But covering that manhunt is another story. I'm Kathy Lohr.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. More than 2 years after the recession officially ended, mayors across the country are still struggling to balance their city budgets. This week, NPR has been taking a close look at several cities. Today, Philadelphia. It avoided many of the big public employee layoffs seen in other cities. NPR's Jeff Brady reports one reason is because Philadelphia bucked the national trend and raised taxes.
Since 2008, Philadelphia has increased taxes on a regular basis. In 2009, the sales tax doubled from 1 to 2%. The next year, property taxes went up 10%. This year, property taxes are going up again, almost 4%. These tax hikes are temporary, but they allow Democratic Mayor Michael Nutter to say this to a crowd at a downtown senior citizen center.
Our budget is stable. All 70 of our swimming pools are open, every rec center is open, every library is open, every park is open, and all of our services are being provided because we make the tough decisions.
Raising taxes wasn't Mayor Nutter's first choice. Shortly after taking office in 2008, he started with a plan to make dramatic cuts that included shutting down libraries. But the cuts did not go over well. Political analyst Terry Madonna teaches public affairs at Franklin and Marshall College.
They were roundly opposed by a whole variety of people, and I think that sort of set the stage for about how far city officials could go politically with cutting services.
But even in raising taxes, Mayor Nutter has had trouble getting what he wants. The most recent example was a tax on sugary drinks the city council rejected. In a town where alliances and political machines still matter, Nutter has billed himself as a reformer. Sometimes he's seen as aloof and certainly not gregarious. But lately, the mayor has tried to soften his image. He was seen jumping into a city pool with children at the beginning of summer, and recently he was in a poor section of town helping crews pave a narrow street.
Big, big round of applause for the work that they're doing out here. Great, great job. Great job, guys.
Mayor Nutter likes to be seen as doing things, and he took this photo opportunity to the next level, you might say. He actually climbed up on the paving equipment and rode it down the street, examining the new blacktop along the way. Resident Vanessa McDuffie watched from in front of her house, but the paving job was not what she wanted to talk about.
Well, we have a bad case of raccoons around here. They run up and down the street.
So what do you want the city to do about the raccoons?
Well, we need the city to come out here and clean up the streets and clean up the blocks and clean up these lots and cut some of these trees down that's growing, not the trees out here. I'm talking about the weeds that's growing in two trees. We need the city to come out here and to take care of it.
Remember, the mayor himself is driving by, paving the road in front of McDuffie's house, but she wants to talk about the raccoon problem. That provides a glimpse into the life of a mayor governing a large city with lots of problems. Mayor Nutter is quick to point out those problems would be worse right now if the city hadn't raised taxes to maintain services.
And it's because of what we did early on, made the tough choices. Yes, some people did get upset. I think they, you know, maybe a little bit have kind of gotten over it. Some maybe have, some haven't.
Among the dissatisfied, count the city's largest unions. They agreed to no wage increases and other concessions at the start of the recession, but they haven't reached agreement on a new contract with the city.
No, we don't have a good relationship at all right now.
Pete Matthews heads the city's main blue-collar union. He says his members are tired of Mayor Nutter expecting them to give up more of their pay and benefits.
He wants to be a dictator in everything that he does. He dictates terms. He does not sit down and talk. He dictates terms. I have yet to have a negotiation session with the mayor. The sessions have been with his people.
If Mayor Nutter wins re-election in November, as many expect, more difficult financial decisions await him. He estimates the city's pension fund has less than half the money it needs to make future payments. That is a $4 billion shortfall, a number larger than the mayor is proposing for the city's entire budget next year. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
President Obama set off a torrent of tweets yesterday when he asked Americans to send messages to Congress about the debt limit. There was a range of reactions on Twitter. Kelsey Hu tweeted the president, "While I appreciate your efforts to reach a bipartisan compromise on the deficit, you're clogging up my news feed. Stop." Hard to imagine anyone saying that to George Washington. Lisa Elstrom tweeted, "Many Republican representatives, no more time for the blame game. Americans want compromise. Man up. We the people." But the Republican National Committee tweeted the president, "Requesting that people spam members of Congress isn't the same as having a debt plan of your own." Dan H. noticed the Twitter stream from the White House and wrote, "I feel bad for the intern that is typing all of Barack Obama tweets today." Tweets are short messages limited to 140 characters. Lots of people say they can't say anything important at so short a length, but you probably couldn't get Congress to raise the tweet limit in time. And this is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Dwayne Halston and Larry Lime are friends, and nobody knows. They work side by side refinishing furniture in a store owned by Dwayne's father, and they both love the new music that's beginning to take hold of the country in 1963. Dwayne reveres James Brown and performs his numbers with his own teen band, the Amazing Rumblers. Larry, whose full name is Larry Lime, Beacon of Time, Reckoning, Breathe on Me, Nolan, wants to play piano like Thelonious Monk. Together, they hatch a plan to have the Rumblers reproduce James Brown's Live at the Apollo album, note for note, step for step, which Larry shows Dwayne. Cheer, teach, and stand up for each other in Stark, North Carolina. 1963, Dwayne, who was white, and Larry, who was black, have to keep their friendship concealed, like some family embarrassment. That friendship forms the story of The Night Train, the new novel, The Tenth, by Clyde Edgerton. He joins us from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Is this story informed by your own experiences growing up in the 60s in, I gather, Durham?
It certainly is, on many counts. About that time, I was 19, and I joined a band, and the tall, lanky, blonde-headed boy wanted to be James Brown, and they were memorizing Live at the Apollo, the album, and so I had to join in before I actually heard the album. That's when the album was just starting to be played, sometimes the full 35 minutes on black stations and white stations without pause, because there are no pause between songs. Also, I had a friend named Larry Lime, not exactly a friend. He was an acquaintance. I would see him at the store near my home, and we would talk, but we never became friends. We did play some basketball together. So I started using his name when I made up the character temporarily, but when I was writing the book, I tried to find him and couldn't. So I said, I'll just keep his name in there. Maybe I'll come across Larry Lime down the road.
It's interesting because you've got a scene in your book. It's a heart-piercing moment, too, when Dwayne and Larry Lime are playing basketball, and Dwayne's father says to him, what's the phrase, it just don't look right.
That's a scene very much out of my life. My father did ask me when I was playing basketball in my backyard if I would ask Larry Lime to leave. And, you know, it's funny how memory works. I can't remember exactly what happened after that, but it was interesting as a storyteller to be able to take that scene and recreate it and make something new out of it.
Did you discover as a novelist things that you didn't realize as you were growing up in the 60s?
Oh yes. The whole question of segregation and race. And, of course, when you're 12, 14 in a culture in which segregation is the norm, you're in many ways like the cliched fish in the water. So in revisiting this scene, now, I was able to think about the invisible effects of segregation on one relationship.
Help us understand the importance of music.
Well, it's such an amazing time, the late 50s and the early 60s. I remember listening to How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
How much is that doggy in
the window? How much is that doggy in the window? In the early 50s. And that was a big song.
Patty Page, right, I think, right?
Oh, it was right up at the top. And a few years later, along comes Little Richard. So can you imagine having your radio on, driving along, and you hear How Much Is That Dog? And then hear Little Richard. And then even later, James Brown. Even some Dixieland, a song called Midnight in Moscow.
I remember Midnight.
Oh, what a great song.
Kenny Ball, yes. I think. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Music was a large part of my life, and it is a bit cliched, but it's a way people come together.
Tell me about your bigot in this book, almost a central casting villain named Flash Akers, but there are parts of him you can't help but like.
There's a part of me which rebels against the classic mean Southern racist who is nothing more than that. And so I had a chance for Flash to round him out a bit.
I will just explain, he has an elderly, infirmed mother, and Flash, who is not a nice man to all intents and purposes, is wonderful and touching and tender with his mother.
I know very little, if any, shame in looking for what to write about. And my mother's illness, and she died in 2001, was something I'd never translated into fiction. She wasn't at all like Flash's mother, but to me anyway. But certainly it's one of the most memorable times of my life. So I had an opportunity to bring some of my experiences into a fictional context.
1963 was such an enormous milestone in so many ways for the world. You had the March on Washington, Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Of course you had the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Is it important to you that people of the generation of, I gather, your students in North Carolina realize what a different world they've grown up in because of what happened then?
In writing about that time, I had to go back and read a lot, and I did realize, as you just mentioned, what a pivotal time that was. Now in my community in Wilmington, I go to classes, to second grade classes, and I watch black and white children play together as if there's no such thing as race. And then, of course, I watch them in high school, and I think about kids who are teenagers and who are black and who are white and their chances at friendship and how it might be different than 1963. And in some cases, I think it's not. But you hope that young people will read history and realize what happened and why it happened and think about it and see how that might influence and affect their lives with their neighbors.
Clyde Edgerton, his new novel, The Night Train. Mr. Edgerton, thanks so much.
Thank you a lot, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time now for sports. Major League Baseball trade deadline hits at 4 p.m. tomorrow. A little more than a third of the season remaining. Some teams are looking for a last-minute roster boost. Others are just looking for a garage sale. ESPN's Howard Bryant joins us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
We're just a little over 24 hours until the trade deadline. Who might improve themselves?
Well, this is actually my favorite time of the year, believe it or not. A lot of guys like October and September and the pennant races, but this is separation time. I love the fact that the Chicago White Sox are always trying to make deals. They already made two trades. We see the San Francisco Giants got Carlos Beltran to help that anemic offense of theirs. But I think that the best thing about this period is that you have a pretty good number of teams who feel like they can win.
Can the Pittsburgh Pirates last?
It's a great question. I mean, you would like to think that a team that hasn't had a winning record since 1992 would have a little bit of staying power as a motivation to get there. But the bottom line is that they're in a tough division and they've never been there. It's the best story in baseball, even though I can still not forgive the Pirates for making money while that team was awful and for really not being a great team management-wise, but if you are a fan of Clemente and a fan of Stargell and a fan of the Buccos and that team, it's great to have a flagship team since 1883 be back in a pennant race. I hope they hold up. I really think that one thing you want when you get to September 1st is to just be within 3, 4, 5 games and you've got a chance. So this next month is going to be huge for them.
I like following the race in the AL Central.
It's a great race.
Yeah,
it's a great race.
You had the three Great Lakes teams, you know?
Exactly. You've got the Twins that have always been there, perennial playoff team. You've got the White Sox and the Tigers. Both have won pennants. The White Sox won it in 05, and the Tigers won the pennant in 06. And you've got the Cleveland Indians, who were great in the 90s and then fell on hard times after losing all their best players. And so you've got a good 4-team race. And the sad part for them is going to be, because of the Red Sox and the Yankees, that only one team is going to come out of there, I think. So whoever wins the division is actually going to be the team that's going to the playoffs, which is what it should be. That's a real pennant race. You got to win your division to get to October.
The Cubs are 19.5 games out of the NL wild card race. Did you say who? Yes, the Chicago Cubs, okay? Yeah, not a losing record for 18 years. Come on, impress a Cub fan. Obviously, they've spent money in recent years. Really, they've spent money all along. Can I trot a theory by you that I just heard the other night?
All ears.
All right. An umpire, and he says that umpires have it all figured out. The problem is a combination of Wrigley Field and Rush Street. The Cubs, because they play day baseball, play during the hottest part of the day. That tires players out over a long season. The young players stay out on Rush Street until 2 and 3 in the morning, and they have to get into the park by 10 a.m., not 5 p.m., and that tires them out. Anything to
that? That's right. There's no question, Scott, that the baseball calendar, the baseball culture runs on rhythm. And when you play for the Cubs, your rhythm is completely off. Everybody else plays night games, you play day games. But I think that the biggest problem that the Cubs have had over time is that I really do think that they have not settled on a specific philosophy. They've got money, they've got fans, they don't have the passion for winning as much as they do having a good time, which has always been the Cubs' reputation. But I still think that there's no real good reason in a money game for that team not to win.
Howard, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Howard Bryant from ESPN.com, ESPN the magazine, and ESPN the growth hormone. Thanks so much for being with us, Howard.
That's a mean one.
I just read what they put in front of me, my friend.